sorry about that, but I think we will begin, and we're going to continue what we started Tuesday, conclude the presentation on our reading first, and yes, ready for you to come up. You've got a wonderful handout, wonderful materials for our committee. Those who missed are going to have to read on their own. Sorry about that, but let's get this concluded, please.
There you go. Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I'm the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services, the office for which has the responsibility of implementing the Reading First grant. I'm pleased to be here. I'm kind of picking up the second phase of this, second half of this. I was unable to attend Tuesday. What I wanted to do is just remind the committee that we did have some presentation Tuesday that we did talk about federal requirements and guidelines that were given to us as we applied for this grant. Julie Anderson, to my right, explained that. And that we worked very hard with both internal committees and with external committees and with members of this body to generate a good grant project that would benefit kids in this state, provide excellent instruction that has some scientific basis for believing it would make a difference for kids. And I think we've done that. And we're going to continue with Mardale Dunsworth, who is one of my managers in my office, describing sort of the practicalities, who's eligible for the grant, how will we distribute the money, and how will we carry through the project for the next several years.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. I think we're going to pull up the PowerPoint. And we are just going to cut to the chase here. So we're going to go to the end of the PowerPoint presentation that we gave you on Tuesday. And we're going to start with this slide, the summary project plan, which is also on your blue handout. And we have extras at the front table. So I'm going to quickly summarize a 250-page application in short order. And as you're looking at these bullets, I'm just going to summarize very quickly that this grant gave all offices of the Department of Education opportunity to collaborate on the writing of this grant application. Second bullet, we're going to be hiring three experts in scientifically based reading research to serve as Reading First regional coordinators around the state. And Reading First schools will be conducting coordinated assessments. All schools will be doing the same assessments throughout the entire project. The fourth bullet, the Reading First Center at the University of Oregon will provide a two-year professional development series called the Reading First Institutes on Beginning Reading for all Reading First schools. There will be approximately 35 Reading First grants, averaging $275,000 each in the first year. Next page. The Reading First Curriculum Review Panel will be analyzing comprehensive beginning reading programs and supplemental programs for use in Oregon Reading First schools. The Department of Education and the Reading First Center will train and supervise the regional coordinators and a mentor coach for each school in the Reading First program. And we will conduct regular site visits of a sample of schools to ensure high-quality program implementation across all Reading First schools. We'll be providing teachers and schools statewide with the latest information in scientifically based reading research. That's all schools statewide, so we'll have lots of materials for all schools through this project. We'll provide annual statewide professional development pathfinder institutes of beginning reading to schools that are not eligible for Reading First and pre-service institutes. So there will be 35 schools approximately funded the first year, but then we'll have this outreach for an additional probably 20 schools per year, so another 100 to 125 schools that will participate as Pathfinder schools. There'll be access to the DIBLS website. I'm on the next page, page 3. There'll be access to the DIBLS website for the diagnostic assessments at no charge to all Oregon educators. So all K-3 teachers will be able to access the University of Oregon's DIBLS website and have diagnostic assessments for all K-3 students in the state. All statewide professional development will be aligned to the new grade 3 standards and K-2 optional curriculum. We'll be identifying beacon schools from the first group of Reading First schools, and these beacon schools will serve as laboratory schools for the state and for other Reading First schools. We'll be offering a contract to align the state's third grade reading assessment with the Lexile framework, and as a result, every third grader in Oregon will receive a Lexile score and a list of books at the student's reading level. And we'll be conducting leadership institutes through beginning reading and ongoing professional development for all Reading First principals and Pathfinder principals. And there'll be the equivalent of two Oregon Department of Education staff assigned to this project to ensure statewide application, and an additional support person as well. And last, we have we'll be providing technical assistance and online support and review of research through the partnership with the University of Oregon. So that's a quick summary of 250 pages. It'll save you some reading. But we did give you the whole grant application as well, so you can read that in your spare time. I wanted to talk a little... Yes?
Question that. I don't know whether my vice chair here has had an explanation of the Dibbles test. Do you understand what that is, Senator?
I do not know what the Dibbles test is.
Would you give us a quick...
Okay, Dibbles are small one-minute probes that are given to K through 2 students to ascertain their knowledge level, phonemic awareness primarily.
Yep.
He's got it.
Yep, I know.
Yeah.
80% accuracy, right?
80, 85.
It would depend
on that for retention.
You're good.
Very good.
The reports are online and come back within 20 seconds. The teacher enters all the data and then can track a student's progress.
So it's that quick feedback that's really really nice about the Dibbles system. I want to talk just a couple minutes about the resources that we're providing around this grant. And one is the web page that we have up on the Oregon Department of Education website. We have all of the pertinent materials, and this is available statewide, as well as frequently asked questions arise as we're in the middle of the application process, and we're updating that about every other week. The timeline for this project, November 12th, we had an orientation workshop for 200 district administrators from the 20 eligible districts. On December 19th, they were to submit their letter of intent to apply. And on January 7th, we held a grant writing workshop at the Holiday Inn in Portland for 500 teachers. A representative team from every eligible school attended and every district attended. And it was quite well received. On March 3rd, the district applications will be due to the Department of Education. On April 17th, the grants will be approved and funded through the State Board of Education. And on June 16th through 20th, we'll begin our professional development with the Institute on Beginning Reading. And that institute will involve all licensed K-3 staff from Reading First schools, all principals of the schools, the K-3 teachers, special education teachers, Title I teachers, and English language learner specialists. In addition, district special ed specialists are invited to attend, and a district team.
Excuse me. The site coordinator for the program, is that one of these individuals here? Or
the reading coach?
Yeah, the reading coach.
Yes.
One of these individuals would be designated as the reading coach.
In addition, the reading coach for each school will attend the Institute on Beginning Reading, and they will participate in the leadership strand throughout that institute. We thought you might want to know how Reading First funds can be used. They can be used for professional development as described in the Oregon application that you received. They can be used for scientifically based reading programs and supplemental materials. So they'll be purchasing new basic materials as well as new supplemental materials. They'll be doing an audit of their program and selecting those materials based on their student population and their student needs. They will be supporting a full-time reading coach for each school. And they'll be supporting classroom library books at $25 per student per school. And they will also receive 80 days of substitute release time for their teachers to participate in professional development outside of the Institute on Beginning Reading. There'll be 9 days that those teachers will attend the Institute on Beginning Reading. There'll be an additional release time available for them to attend other professional development that might be based around the materials that they're purchasing. There are 21 eligible districts for this grant, and in your packet that you received on Tuesday, you had the full list of eligible schools. There were 78 schools that were listed. 16 districts decided to apply. 47 schools applied on behalf within those 16 district applications. We anticipate 30 to 35 schools to be funded this first round of funding. The average award will be $275,000 per school. And as I mentioned earlier, there'll be an additional statewide outreach to 20 to 25 schools per year in the Pathfinder portion of this application. So that was the quick wrap-up of Reading First. That concludes our presentation. If you have any questions, we would be happy to answer them for you.
And just in summary, I'd like to just go back over three numbers that are I think, really indicative of the interest and the effort that school districts have. We had 250 staff from schools on November just to learn about writing the grant from these school districts. 500 of those people came back to a workshop in January to learn more about the program, learn more about the process, learn about how they can participate in this program. And we're expecting 800 teachers and administrators in June to actually learn the details and the instructional programs that Reading First supports. So we are getting tremendous support from the field, which indicates two things. One is it's a very good grant, and it's supporting the right things to do with kids. And secondly, that the department has put its finger on what the pulse of what schools really need, which is assistance in helping teachers learn how to teach reading better. So I believe that we've written a good grant and that school districts are interested and want to do this.
Matt?
Yes.
I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the presentation, and I think I heard part of this last session in the House Education Committee, and I understand the program, I think, and my concern is the worst case scenario now. As I remember, you're up to 85% of the people at the end of the third grade can read. Is that the figure that?
85% of Oregon students are
okay.
Reading.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm concerned about the worst case scenario, the 15%, and how do you identify the students who have. Normal students, not talking about identified for special needs, special ed, just normal kids of normal intelligence, and what problems they have, because if you're ever going to go above 85%, you've really got to concentrate on those that you are the least easy to reach. I mean, the really hard cases, which means you might have to spend more time in the home with parents, you might have to, work at I understand the court system. In fact, there are if a parent is not taking responsibility for having their kids in school and doing what they're supposed to be doing, they are legally liable. And to do all of those things, and I would hope that, because if you're doing a good job with the low hanging fruit, so to speak, or the easier cases, I'm sure that. You get up to 50%, 70%, and then it gets harder and harder, and you get up to 85%, which, and then you go beyond that, is really hard. You get up into that 95%, and then you're, and I don't know how many, I don't know how much it's, what resources are worth spending on that small percentage, but those are the kids who will end up in the penal system and on welfare and all that stuff. So I think that. That's what I'm interested in, is closing that gap.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morrison, I think you're absolutely right. And there, I don't know if I call them low-hanging fruit. I believe that there, some percentage of those, of the 15% will improve their skills.
The low-hanging fruit is on the front end.
Right. The 85%. Some of that 15% of the students that may still need some additional assistance will be addressed by this program. It'll be by improving teachers' strategies in the classroom, by the kinds of materials that teachers will be using with those kids. So we will get some improvements there. But there still are kids that, for whatever set of variables, will be difficult to reach, and we need to take a real close look at that, and we need to look for other resources. We are looking at a couple of federal grants that would wrap around and surround this program, as well as provide some assistance for grades 4 through 12, which, as much as this is a major step forward in increasing reading instruction in the state of Oregon, we still have for additional grades that we need to address. And so we're taking a look at resources. What can we do in terms of federal grants and other alternatives that we can start focusing on the total population of schools?
Yes. Well, and I I think I mentioned this last time we met, remedial programs in the fourth grade, immediate identification of those kids, if they have to be passed on for social reasons, you know, then you work with them to bring them up to speed. Now the alternative is to say, okay, if you can't read by the end of the third grade, you repeat. You know, that may not be the most practical, I don't know, but if they do go on, that they just are not then forgotten about, like fourth, fifth, and sixth grades.
As I understand the program, with the three times a year grade level testing, you're going to be able to identify students who are struggling quickly with that immediate feedback on the testing. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that get extra attention immediately. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be helping to solve that problem with that 15% because of the mandatory testing requirement and the availability of the Dibbles test itself, that we're going to have that online available. Very important, I think. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
You bet. We'll be talking with you further. Sure.
Thank you.
And now we're going to shift gears, and everybody's got a printout of this informational hearing today, and so I'm going to confuse things by reversing the order, and I'm going to call up Rob Wagner and Lori Wimmer. Do you have anyone coming with you, Lori? Please.
Are you reversing the order just to see if they're here on time? Is that
yeah.
Good. Good.
Appreciate it.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
I don't know how you want to handle the order here, but I only have just a couple minutes of testimony to provide, and I really appreciate the opportunity to, let me say at the outset, to address the committee early on in session. Look forward to working with everyone throughout the legislative session. So for Chair Starr and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Wagner. I'm the new Director of Government Relations for the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. AFT Oregon is the state federation of 20 local affiliates of the American Federation of Teachers. We represent over 10,000 employees in K-12 schools, community colleges, public and private higher education institutions in both faculty and classified positions. We also represent healthcare workers, childcare workers in Oregon, and our members live in every legislative district in the state. Given the variety of work experience from our membership, you can imagine that our legislative priorities for AFT are quite broad. For additional information, I know as a former staffer here that you don't get enough information in your inbox every day, you know, so I thought I could just throw some more paper at you to read. I did provide a copy of our brochure, which outlines our 2003 legislative agenda. This brochure was compiled by our membership, and it details the issue areas of concern to our members in greater detail. Now, in terms of education policy and the types of bills that we'll be working on this committee, I have a couple just brief comments. First, as a caveat, let me just say that I'm aware that I'm not addressing the revenue committee here, but our members are quite united in their push for one overarching goal this session, which is a stable and sufficient funding source for education from pre-K through higher education. I have a feeling this might echo testimony you'll hear from other individuals today, but adequate and stable funding for education, neither of which our members feel we have achieved, is really the fulcrum around which any discussion about education policy must revolve. Our new governor and legislative leaders have talked about the importance of attracting businesses and fostering business growth in Oregon, which we completely agree with. Economic development, though, cannot happen without a strong network of K-12 schools, community colleges, and higher education institutions. With the recent national reporting, I think just yesterday there was an article in the Oregonian that talked about NBC Nightly News, New York Times, USA Today, about talking about school closures in Oregon. I think this problem is quite apparent. In terms of the specific issues that will come before this committee, AF2R are going to be interested in working with you on compliance with the 2001 amendments to the federal ESEA, or the No Child Left Behind Act, especially as it pertains to a group of our members who are paraprofessionals, also known as educational assistants. In addition, we certainly respect, we appreciate your respect for our state collective bargaining law, and we should continue to allow school and community college boards, along with employees, to determine salary compensation and conditions of employment through local democratic avenues. And finally, and especially in this time of fiscal uncertainty, we feel it an important priority to guard against the draining of funds from public schools. I'd like to sum up by saying I really appreciate, again, the opportunity to introduce AFT Oregon and our agenda to you today. This is my first legislative session with AFT, and I do look forward to working with you on behalf of our members in the state of Oregon. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have of me.
Any questions?
Well, briefly, your range is K, including community college.
Right, we have community college. Actually, in your senatorial district, we have two big locals are the classified at Lane Community College, uh-huh. And then we also have the graduate teaching fellows at the University of Oregon. Oh, okay. That we have quite a few members that live in your Senate district. So,
good. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very
much. Thank you. Appreciate it. And if I may, I'm actually going to excuse myself because I have to jump on over to another committee. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. And I, too, want to thank you for having us come before you today. I hope it's the first of many opportunities to talk with you about the issues that will confront you in this session. I have with me our president, Chris Kane, who will be speaking to you a little bit about our legislative priorities. And in addition, I've given you our new hot-off-the-press legislative brochure that addresses some of the key issues of our organization, and you can see that it has a nice quote on one side. That side can actually be a poster if you choose to put it up, so you'll never forget us.
Yeah.
With that, let me turn over the mic to my president, Chris Kane, and I'm going to stand by to answer any questions you might have.
Good afternoon. I want to apologize to begin with. I'm a little bit under the weather, but it was really important to me to come today and talk to you, so if I fade in and out, that'll be why. On behalf of our 45,000 members statewide, I thank you for the opportunity to share our goals for the 2003 legislative session. We are composed of teachers, educational support professionals, community college faculty all throughout the state. We normally have a broad agenda on a variety of issues in most legislative sessions, but that will not be the case this time. Oregon's school funding crisis is so severe that we believe it's necessary to put all of our efforts into helping to bring about a stable and adequate funding system. Our members have made that the top priority of our organization. We consider public education to be Oregon's greatest asset. It is our best economic development tool and our best crime prevention tool. It is, however, impossible to realize a return on an investment if we do not make that investment. We support a level of investment in our K-12 system that aligns with the recommendations of the quality education model. And I also serve on the Quality Education Commission. Though the recession has dashed our hopes of achieving that funding level in the next biennium, we are working to make sure that this setback is never repeated. That's not to say that we don't have other issues of concern, but only that OEA's highest priority will be on making sure that Oregon students are not shortchanged either in the next biennium or for the long run. To that end, we will be vigilant about protecting the resources that will be appropriated to the K-12 and community college systems to ensure that they are not diluted or rerouted to new programs. Meanwhile, we will be supporting in other committees revenue reforms to deliver more revenue on behalf of public education and other vital programs. So, again, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today, and between the two of us, we'd be glad to address any questions that you have.
Yes.
There has been a series of articles in the Oregonian about the formula and funding distribution and so on, and it kind of surprised me. I always assumed that maybe it was the rural districts that was having the least amount of funding for special ed and so on, but it turns out to be different than that somewhat. Are you going to do anything? Are you going to weigh in on that discussion on distribution of funding?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, we have always taken keen interest in the debates around the distribution formula, which is, of course, not about baking a bigger pie, but rather grabbing for the slices and changing their proportions. And any fix to the system that our proposed advantage and disadvantage districts differently. And so we always have kind of a careful or a cautious approach to such proposals, knowing that they always create a list of winners and losers. I kind of jokingly refer to the distribution formula fights as Oregon's version of pork barreling, because very frequently legislators look for ways to bring home a larger share to their district at the expense of the rest, and we don't really think that that's good public policy representing all the teachers and their students throughout the state of Oregon. So it would be our goal to try to minimize those kinds of battles.
And I guess in light of my concern and follow-up, may I?
Sure.
Having visited rural schools and rural health care facilities, they are the heart of the rural community, and if it's an economic development issue, because if a company is going to move to rural Oregon, they, good schools and good health care, and you close a local school and that's the heart of the community. And so I have a lot of concern. And I know they used an example, three students in a class and $35,000 and so on. We have to keep those schools open somehow. And I don't know if it comes under the distribution funding or some economic. I know there's got to be a way of doing that. I just hate to see those schools closed.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, we agree with that. And what we think the solution really is not tinkering with the distribution formula, but tinkering with the revenue system and making sure that there are adequate resources on the table for all schools and all students.
One of them is not going to happen.
Colonel.
Good. Thank you.
Serious discussion around that issue, I'm sure. Further questions? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do y'all define stable and adequate school funding?
Mr. Chair and Senator Deckard, we are comfortable with the definition that the Quality Education Commission has been putting forward for now two biennia, because they rest their calculations on those elements of the standards the state has adopted as a matter of state law. So we feel that it makes common sense to fund your ambitions as defined by law. So that's how we determine what an adequate level of funding, for example, for K-12 is.
Mm-hmm. That is referred to as a QEM, isn't it?
Yes.
I thought you were going to say pie in the sky.
May I ask a question?
Please.
Do you think that will ever happen without a constitutional amendment fixing some funding for education? Or, because... you don't have to answer that. You can if you want.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, I'd be delighted to answer that. I think actually that revenue reform is the only hope we have, not just for education, but for all programs Oregonians deem vital. And I think we're about to see how much Oregonians do value their state on January 28th in a very close vote, I'm sure. But I think that that Oregonians move here and stay here for all kinds of reasons, but chief among them are a high-quality public education system, and we have a lot to be proud of here with respect to how our students perform.
May I add to my concern? I think it's easy for all of us to pay lip service to education first. There's not a single person in here who wouldn't say that. Unfortunately, there's a limited amount of money that goes into the general fund, and I can assure you that education is not going to be funded first, in my view, unless there is a constitutional amendment which fixes part of the general fund in other ways. I mean, otherwise, we go through this exercise every year, and we all start out by saying how important it is, but it's difficult, and I don't know that we will solve this problem, because we haven't solved it since early 1990. The state has not done its part. Probably never will.
One man's opinion.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
yes.
One thing that I think might
offer some hope is that the OEA, along with a lot of other organizations, have participated in the funding of an organization whose sole purpose is to raise the revenue literacy, if you will, of the average Oregonian, and has developed a curriculum module to talk about where your tax dollar goes, what it buys. It's very easy to understand. We're going out into community by community all throughout the state of Oregon, and while for decades now we have failed to see changes because all we've done is put the question on the ballot without that kind of backup and education, we're trying to do it differently now, and that's what gives me hope. I don't think it's hope in a vacuum.
Yes. Appreciate it very much.
Mr. Chair, I would just chime in on that same note. Just because of the level of pessimism, I think Tuesday might prove that all of, at least some of our thoughts, just the initial numbers that we're seeing, at least some of our thoughts turned out to be incorrect, and some of our assumptions, certainly mine, turned out to be incorrect in terms of Oregonians' willingness and their ability to gauge what services they value and which they don't. And I think it'll only assist us in a debate about revenue restructuring and reform to have that kind of question put forth in January of a biannual legislative session.
Okay. May I respond to that? No, I want to finish my thought.
Let's let Senator Kelly have a say here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we are going to have a lesson on Tuesday. If Measure 28 passes, we're going to have a lesson of turning $310 million into $450 million by some prestidigitation, because the people that are voting for Measure 28 are doing so because they expect it to fill the gap. And various interest groups, and from seniors to healthcare professionals to education specialists, have told folks, vote yes and we'll save our, and then you fill in the blank. Problem is, it won't. So we're going to get a lesson in either figuring out how it is that we make that we fulfill the expectations of many people who've been told that those dollars, if they are authorized, will fill the gap, and they won't, or dealing with the approximately $450 million shortfall that we will face to get us from the 30th of September through the 30th of June, because as you recall, we only balanced the budget through September 1st in our special sessions. So I agree with both of my colleagues from the Senate when they say that we might get some real eye-opening, maybe even eye-popping lessons on Measure 28.
Well, I said, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I was one of the few people before, during the special session, that said this will pass. I've always felt it will pass because there's so much at stake in all areas, and I agree that people are each looking at their own area. However, it's what happens after it passes, because that's just the beginning. You know, we have a $1.5 billion expected deficit next, starting in July, and so on. So I think the voters are paying attention, and they will pass this measure, but that's just the beginning. And looking at the long-term funding solution, we have to overhaul our tax system, and we have to find, I think, a new or a different source of revenue to kind of offset some of the others or stabilize, and then that's when we come into deciding on the long-range funding for education, because right now, under the current system, there's no way we can assure long-term funding for anything. And so I'm optimistic that we will come up with, and I don't know where we are on that. I know there have been committees working on the, coming up with a new system that has a better balance. Washington is thinking about doing income tax. We're thinking about doing sales tax, and both of us are equally
uncertain.
Anyway,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ed Edwards.
Thank you, Chair Starr. And I want to thank the committee for inviting the Oregon School Employees Association to speak to the committee today. My name is Ed Edwards. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon School Employees Association. We're located at 4735 Liberty Road South in Salem, Oregon. OSCA has a membership of, represents 20,000 classified school employees who work in Oregon K through 12 schools, community colleges, education service districts, and Head Start agencies. We're the folks that usually are termed as other staff that work in the school. But I kind of like what the Oregonian said about classified when they were commenting on our pledge during the summer months, when they called classified the thread that holds schools together. The number one concern that we have mirrors that of the Oregon Education Association, and that is finding a solution to Oregon's long-term school funding problem. That is why our organization, during the past 6 months, has promoted a program asking legislators, organizations, and individual Oregonians to sign a pledge to solve the school funding problem before the 2003 legislative session adjourns. Currently, in this legislature today, there are 34 state representatives and 15 state senators who have signed that pledge. Our organization is committed to making sure that folks keep the pledge. Our organization believes that we can solve this problem. This OSCA believes that we cannot wait any longer. We can't accept delays because our kids are in school today. And what we don't provide our children is education delayed, is education denied. We face a choice. We can adequately fund our schools so it meets the expectations of parents and students, lawmakers, and our citizens, or we can continue to slowly dismantle our public education system, which we're doing currently by eliminating curriculum, closing schools, and shortening the school year, and cutting staffing levels in order to balance school budgets. Our union truly believes that OSCA, that Oregon, can provide a world-class education to its students, as it is outlined in the 21st Century School Reform Act, as it is defined by the Quality Education Commission. We also believe that Oregonians will support the funding of that goal. We believe Oregon is ready for the debate, is ready to make the choices, is ready to hear the arguments, and cast a vote if it takes an initiative or a constitutional amendment. Our organization believes that now is the time to start asking Oregonians, engage them in debate, and give them the choice. We do not believe we need to talk to Oregonians anymore. We've been doing that for years. They understand the issue. It's really going to come down to a choice. Just as we're facing on the 28th, we need to provide that opportunity to Oregon voters. In addition to the education funding, we have another issue that is very important to our membership, and that is the implementation of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that was passed in January of 2002 by the federal government, signed into law by President Bush. This particular act is full of new mandates and requirements for our K through 12 schools. One of those requirements is for to have highly qualified educational assistants that work in Title I funded programs or Title I funded schools throughout the state. We specifically have an issue in regards to what is the definition of highly qualified and how to meet those definitions. A highly qualified educational assistant is one that has 2 years of college, has attained an associate's degree, or passes a rigorous state assessment. That is what the federal governments are requiring of our educational assistants. Those who were hired prior to January 2002 have until 2006 to meet these new requirements, or they will no longer qualify to be an educational assistant in a Title I funded school or program. New hires in these programs must meet the requirements now upon hire. Our major concern is with the state assessment. We have, from the very beginning, tried to work with school districts and the Department of Education, and even at the federal level, we are pushing this as well, that the states need to create one test. The written rigorous assessment should be one rigorous state assessment developed by the state, provided to the districts to use when they're hiring educational assistants that assist our students in instruction in reading, writing, and math. Unfortunately, several months ago, the Superintendent of Public Instruction sent out a memorandum requiring districts to create their own assessment. And that is causing all types of confusion out in our districts today. It is just simply a mandate that was passed from the federal government to the state, and the state has passed it down to the local school districts. We have a real concern about whether or not these assessments will meet the standard of rigor, and we also have a real concern as EAs move from one district to another, whether or not the assessment they passed at one district is going to be accepted in the other. We really believe that that's an important issue that we should address. The other issue is training. I think if the Elementary and Secondary Education Act says anything, it says that we have to continue and be vigilant about providing training to educational staff, and that includes classified. Unfortunately, in the past, as education training dollars and staff development dollars have moved from the federal government or from the state government to the districts, classified have had the short end of the stick in this area, and we are expressing a concern that maybe we need to specifically address the dollars we set aside for classified training to maintain their high-quality status working in our schools. We also have a concern about school construction, new classroom building, and extensive repairs that some of our districts are facing year in and year out due to deferred maintenance because of lack of funding. And we would hope that somehow we can help, the state can help these districts meet those financial needs. And finally, I would just say that the state of Oregon and its public education system depends on quality staff within each college, ESD, or K-12 school. We must never forget that the recruitment and retention of qualified teachers, classified, and administrators is essential if we're going to achieve the goals that we set forth in legislation and meet the expectations of parents and students. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yeah.
Senator Marsette.
Thank you. The Department of Education developing the statewide assessment or having the districts do theirs of the staff and so on. I imagine that we will have them come before us and talk about this. And that's an interesting topic that we will.
Good question. Is there anything, have you proposed legislation addressing this issue?
Well, to be quite honest, Chair Starr, we about a month ago, we received a memorandum from the Department of Ed that said that they were going to develop a state assessment. Yesterday, we got a memorandum from the Department of Ed that said, no way, we're not going to develop a state assessment for districts to use. So we were not going to introduce legislation up until we got that particular piece of news. But we also, we're working very closely with the Department of Ed, and I don't want you to think that I'm slamming them, because we work with them very closely, and we want to try to settle this matter without having to put legislation out there. And we're going to do an outreach this week just to see if we can set up an appointment with the right people to talk about this issue some more.
Further question?
Well, I think that's the right approach. I mean, if it's an administrative rule that can be worked out, and it would be interesting to have them come before us, and at some point after you've met with them and have them, you know, and talk about it again, I think that would be the way to go.
Thank you.
But, yeah. Good? Thank you.
Further questions? Well, thank you very much,
Chair.
Now, we move on, and I got, I believe, John Marshall and Chuck Bennett. Gilman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I was going to start off today by welcoming you back, but it seems like we never left. Our agenda for this legislative session I could describe in one word, and that's brief. I think given the financial circumstance that schools find themselves in after the five special sessions, our focus is going to be on to try to assure that there are no additional requirements imposed on school districts, and we can hopefully use this experience of financial exigency as an opportunity. And I like to think that we're in a hole, but we have a potential of climbing out of the hole. And we believe that the governor's budget, given the overall financial constraints in which that was prepared, creates an opportunity for us to begin to climb up the side of that hole. So I'm not going to suggest that we're halfway in the hole. I'm going to suggest that we're coming halfway out of the hole. One of the key agendas, I think, that we have for this legislative session is to preserve our performance-based education system. I think the work that's been done over the last 10 years to establish standards for our students in terms of their academic achievement, a way to rationally assess how well our students are doing against those standards, is valuable. And it's one that the folks I represent, being accountable to you and their communities for the achievement of students in school districts, need to show how well our students are doing. And certainly the No Child Left Behind Act suggests that states establish standards for student achievement and create an assessment system for those students. It's interesting to note that in the early 70s, Oregon enacted laws creating for the education of students with disabilities before the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act was passed. And after the federal law, there was a great deal of work done on the part of the Oregon legislature to bring state law in line with the federal requirements. And I think that's what we have to do now. We're very fortunate in Oregon because we have made significant advancements in developing standards for our students, assessing how well our students are doing against those standards. So what we have to do is take the federal act and combine it with what we're doing so that schools have a single playbook. That is a single guidelines on which to operate. We're fortunate here because Oregon has made such progress. Many other states don't have standards. They don't have statewide assessments. So we're ahead of the curve, and I think we ought to recognize that, be proud of it, and work very diligently to assure that the federal government understands the progress we've made and give us the flexibility to move forward. A great deal of discussion has occurred surrounding mandates. And a suggestion that there are these mandates that if we simply relieve from school districts, it will save tens of millions of dollars. And I want to suggest to you that if you go through the list of statutory mandates imposed on school districts, there aren't that many. There are many requirements for school district operations in areas of program and personnel and so forth. But those are simply an attempt by the legislature to assure that schools operate uniformly throughout the state. If you ask school districts about the most significant mandates imposed on them, the first one that would most likely point out is special education. And that, of course, is a federal requirement and one that we cannot change. The second, and certainly the most onerous, or becoming the most onerous, is PERS. And the significant drain that's creating on school district resources, given the anticipated rates that the PERS board is ready to announce that will go into effect on July 1. And certainly, I don't think there's anybody in the building that's not interested in getting a handle on that, and there are a lot of good minds at work. And finally, I would say that while we haven't gotten any ideas solidified, we will be looking at every opportunity for ways to help school districts retool. And I think that oftentimes, both in the private sector and the public sector, a decline in resources causes folks to step back and sort of analyze what we're doing, how we're doing it, and to try to figure out ways to deliver our product more efficiently and effectively if we want to stay in business. Schools don't have a choice. We have to stay in business. So that creates, I think, a mandate, if I could use that term, want us to begin to think about ways that we can deliver our educational program even more efficiently and effectively. And I'd like to think that although the last year has been a difficult one, it's like trying to repair an aircraft in flight, trying to determine how you balance a budget when from one week to the next of the current school year, you don't know where resources are coming from. So I'm hopeful that this will cause many school districts to, as I suggested, retool and rethink, and we'll be searching for ways to help them do that and looking for all kinds of tools that may be available to them to give them that opportunity. We stand ready to work with you. We'll be here. And if you have ideas, we're certainly willing to help you advance them. And if you have some ideas, we'll be certainly also willing to suggest that they're not very good ones. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll close and offer our assistance over the next several months in any way we can.
Appreciate that. Any questions for Mr. Marshall?
No, please, Your Honor. You want me to go ahead?
Were you asking me a question, sir?
No, I was asking if there were questions.
You said it so well, Mr. Marshall. You covered it all.
Okay.
You did well. No questions.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Just so you know, there is an echo in here. We're in full agreement with the other education organizations regarding stable and adequate funding for education in the state as our top priority. We have a series of guidelines we're measuring any program against. We are concerned that any funding measure assure equal educational opportunity for all students regardless of per student property wealth of an individual school district, that it provide an adequate and consistent level of funding allowing long range program and fiscal planning, and retain funding for the activities of the education service districts. I've supplied you a copy of our legislative platform, which goes through a whole series of what we support and oppose around school finance, capital improvements, governance. Just generally, in governance, we continue to be committed to locally governed public schools, locally elected school boards in local school districts. We believe that is the best way to govern schools in the state of Oregon. Hope you agree, and that there is not a that any effort to have this turn into a 90-member school board is avoided to the extent possible. We believe the instructional and operational program is a vital part of a school system. That program indicates who will be taught, defines what will be taught, indicates how teaching will occur, and how learning will be assessed. With that in mind, we have a series of issues we both support and oppose relative to the educational program. Suffice it to say, we are certainly not interested in any further curriculum mandates and hope that you'll take a close look at those, but we certainly are prepared to take a look at all existing mandates, to go over them with you, and have had an opportunity to join with Mr. Marshall in making an evaluation of them. I think we have some interesting ideas. In terms of, I've given you our thoughts on personnel and licensing, on collective bargaining, and also on the PERS system. Quite simply, we believe that all school employees deserve a fair and reasonable retirement income based on the level of contributions to the retirement program. And we have assigned Ozzie Rose to represent us as carefully as possible in the PERS discussions going on in the building, and will be, we think, involved in the final, we hope, in the final decision. We'd be glad to answer any questions you may have. I think my colleagues have covered most of the specifics, I think, that all of us will be talking about this session.
Thank you. I attended a health conference in November, and there are, I guess, what some consider profound changes taking place in school in terms of lunch programs, of the presence of vending machines in the school, and concerning nutrition, or lack of adequate control over what people are eating, drinking while they're there. Have your associations been talking about that as a potential problem? It's not having to do with the classroom. It's having to do with students' health and what's available to them.
We certainly would be willing.
Have you had that discussion among yourselves? I mean, this is what I'm wondering if this is a problem that has risen up to the level of when administrators and school board members get together.
We've not had a discussion that I've seen at COSA about it, but in talking with local school district folks, I think that there's a lot of discussion that goes on at their level regarding their nutrition programs, and certainly we'd be glad to discuss it with you in great detail. We have a lot of people who are really quite expert in it relative to our breakfast and lunch programs and what's going on in those nutrition programs, what the offerings look like. I've been surprised myself. I had a look at the nutrition program. We're going to be doing sponsoring a back-to-school week in the final week of April. If you'll recall, there is in your districts a back-to-school week at your local schools. We'll be putting one on here at the Capitol for you April 28th, 29th, and 30th, and we'd hope you all would come down and visit. We're going to have, a real good look at what's going on in the public schools, and this isn't going to be an event where you hear what's wrong. You're going to hear what's right about schools. We're going to offer a lunch program based on what my experience was like, 35, 40 years ago, and it's going to be green Jell-O and corn dogs, which is what, because that's what I think of as hot lunch. And then I got to look at the menu, and it was really interesting to me to see how complex it's gotten. And we'll be giving you a lot of information about the nutrition programs at that time and what's going on in the schools.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore said in response to your question you asked earlier about a definition of adequate. And I think a definition of adequate school funding is where we reach the point that we don't have to rely on Pepsi and Coke to outbid each other to put money into our schools.
I agree. Well, if I may, I think that's something that I would be interested in hearing about. I'm not thinking necessarily of any legislation, but I know it's an increasing problem, and they're closing in the District 4J particularly. They're looking at farming out the lunch program, and I don't know if they're going to open it up to the fast food people to come in and provide lunches.
We've got both models, farmed out and farmed in, and we can sure anytime you want to have it, the chairman would like to pull together a panel to discuss nutrition in the schools.
Maybe the policy committee would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And we're engaged in, I don't want to leave that with that facetious remark, we are engaged with other educational groups in a project called Healthy Schools, where we look at the kind of nutrition students are getting, their eating habits, the question of obesity of our students, physical education, and so forth, to try to bring all those things together. Recognize there is, in fact, a problem.
It's interesting, may I?
Senator Morris.
I read an article in the paper, and it was an angry letter to the editor saying that the school district just bought this new bus to take kids to school, and they canceled their PE class. Of course, they didn't explain how far the kids had to be transferred, but I mean, just that idea that kids don't, well, of course, it's not always safe to walk to school anymore, and so there are a lot of reasons why they do it. But anyway, it's.
Questions, Senator? A couple comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you. When Senator Morissette went to school, the only thing on the school lunch menu was fried lard. And that's how far back that goes.
I never ate lunch at school. I always walked home through 5 feet of Thoen Ron Kennedy to my lunch.
Mr. Chairman, I'm semi-serious note here. I'm one of those people that believes that many of the mandates, if they were eliminated, really wouldn't save very much money. We get the SimCam discussion going on in the building, and we had since last legislative session. But I am having to defend the concept that elimination of some of these mandates won't save money. And I'm finding it's pretty hard to defend those concepts, but I hear on one side of this issue that people feel that eliminating the mandates won't save us any money, and on the other side of that argument, they're saying, for gosh sakes, don't give us any more mandates. Well, if they don't cost any money, what the hell? if they're not going to save any money, why eliminate them?
There have been, Senator Ferrioli, there have been bills introduced that have in fact proposed mandate, that have in fact created mandates on schools. And my colleagues and I have been so talented that we've been able to stop those bills. There have been a number over the last several sessions of curriculum mandates, and now that we have standards and benchmarks, there are always those interests that come in and suggest, well, if you just add this particular requirement to a benchmark or a standard, physical education was one, second language, and the list goes on. So we've been very successful in holding back those mandates, but you're absolutely right. And we've done quite a bit of work over on the House side in trying to put the whole concept of mandates in some kind of a context. And the legislature has created school districts, and they have established, fulfilling their constitutional requirement to assure uniformity in the public school system throughout the state, have created requirements for school districts. So you go through the statute, and Jan did a great deal of work on identifying, in at least the educational statutes, every requirement that the state imposes on school districts. Well, by definition, that requirement is a mandate. But those mandates suggest that we ought to report, that we have certain reporting on student records. And that, well, there are a variety of them that create requirements, but they're not necessarily what you would term mandates that, if eliminated, would save tens of thousands or tens of millions of dollars. So I think it's important to take the requirements and separate those and identify that there are some good mandates and some bad ones. And our method of identifying the difference is a question of, are these issues that the legislature should be imposing on school districts, or are these decisions that are better left to individual elected officials in their own communities? And so I think if you can draw those distinctions. But we have a list of, Jan made a list of all the mandates, and we've gone through that list and winnowed it down. And there are requirements, for example, for Women in History Month and appropriate instruction. Francis E. Willard Day and the appropriate instructions surrounding that. And eliminating those is not going to save, as you suggest, anything at all. So I think we have a lot to add to that discussion. If I've done a lot of work on it, can shed some light on exactly what is a mandate and what it isn't.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. I guess I want to shed at least focus on the irony of hearing the argument, please don't give us any more mandates because they cost too much money, and then when we remove mandates, they don't say anything. That is a difficult position to put legislators in who believe that reduction of these mandates won't create huge dollar savings. Because the argument that countervails that is the fact that if they are expensive and costly, you should be able to make savings by eliminating them. Mr. Chairman, another observation, if I could
please
leave.
Yes.
It was interesting to me to sit through another orientation on the potential for federal funding for phonics instruction, and to actually see people quivering with eager anticipation over the prospect of federal grants for phonics instruction, when those same folks bitterly opposed the idea of curriculum mandates from this committee, a chair, and this committee member about phonics instruction. And the thing that I can identify as the difference is grant funding. So is the weather vane of efficacy and efficiency and applicability just federal funding? Because it's the only thing that changed between last session and this session. The one unwavering proponent of phonics and reading instructions has been the chairman, but apparently now the school districts have discovered that phonics instruction is a pretty good thing.
Referring to the Department of Education presentation?
I am.
Mm-hmm.
Can you care to be heard comment on that?
I think the issue is there are, as you know, Senator Ferrioli and Mr. Chairman, different ways to teach kids how to read. And it's always been our opinion that no single method should be mandated from this body down on to local school districts, or certainly the professional educators in their employ. That different students learn differently, and every available method ought to be in place for the professional educators to determine which is best. And if there are programs that have some money associated with them, be it federal, state, or otherwise, then that ought to maybe create an incentive for the folks in individual school districts or professional educators to try to use that. You have to create, I guess the bottom line is you have to create the flexibility to determine how best students learn and which methods of reading are best suited for it.
Mr. Chairman, I absolutely agree with you on an individual basis for each student, but for a district or a macro approach to providing education, I don't agree with you. We are hearing from the professional educators, and they're saying phonics works, and the federal government's willing to help institute those programs, and apparently the Oregon School Boards Association and others are supporting that, because we're hearing that we're being asked to support the authority to go after the grant applications to make the curriculum changes.
Money these days in schools is a strong incentive.
No, I think these days are like many other days.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, one final thing. It's more of a warning and an admonition than any other thing. I like these gentlemen, because they're in such close contact with the school district administrators, to carry that message for me. I am, with the chairman's permission and approval, going to ask each school district administrator to break out and detail their spending on English as a second language. I'm not going to allow administrators to sit in front of me and make a presentation without being able to tell me how much ESL money goes into a school, what specific spending and what programs he spends it on, and how can I connect the education of students with English as a second language as a target with that expenditure. So please let folks know that when they come to the committee, I'm going to ask them, if we don't take up committee time, I'll expect to get their budget breakouts that break out ESL spending by teacher, by class, by period, and the number of ESL kids they have in their system. Thank you.
And I would like to say, in response to this, having the variety of methods of teaching reading, that is a really good idea. The problem is that for almost 50 years we've excluded the teaching of phonics to the detriment of our nation and the dumbing down of our nation in a horrendous way, because not only is it not provided, it's not utilized. And it's been that way because teacher training colleges for years have trained teachers in a variety of ways, and they've used some implicit phonics, but nothing that deals with explicit, systematic phonemic awareness and phonics instruction. And I'm a little fearful that even with these federal funds, which specify it, five great ideas about reading, that start off with phonemic awareness and phonics, and then they go on to fluency, and where are the other two? Comprehension and vocabulary. Five important ideas in reading. But they started off with these first two, phonemic awareness and phonics. But there's a variety of ways to teach that. The little kids seeing an alphabet letter can reproduce that graphically. And if they hear it pronounced correctly, they can reproduce the sound. They can be judged instantly by the teacher whether they're getting it or not. In a very short period of time, they learn the sounds of the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And if they learn that as a basis of our English language, then they're going on to be able to read their vocabulary words. If they got 4,000 vocabulary words, they're going to read them pretty quick. If they got 24,000 vocabulary words, they're going to read them pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
Because they understand how to decode and do that. But we have not been doing that in our schools, despite all the protestations to the contrary. Hasn't been happening. And
but Mr. Chairman, if I could, let me ask you this. If you look at the report card from the Department of Education that was just published, it shows a significant improvement in third graders meeting the reading benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
which indicates that we're doing something right. Now, maybe that's attributable to phonics. Maybe it's attributable to something else. Maybe it's attributable to the focus that's been placed on early grade reading programs.
I think there's
a movement in the right direction. So
it is. Absolutely. Movement in the right direction. But we've been 20 years getting some movement in the right direction since A Nation at Risk. And I think everybody wants to do better. I really believe they do. Mm-hmm. And I think we have an opportunity. We're going to have a lot of fun this session. This committee meets Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we've allotted this that time slot. I don't know that we're going to do much in this committee. The funding issues are elsewhere, and that's the big issue. We very likely will hear debate about continuation of the performance model.
Okay.
I think that is one of the things that we're very intent upon doing.
Okay.
So there's no further questions or comments. We will adjourn for this week. Thank you kindly.
Senator Ferriello.